Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com. Hey, Cadence, you want to be on TV? The hilarious TLC TV show, Sex Sent Me to the ER, is now casting nationwide for new episodes. You might recall them from previously being on the Sex with Simmery podcast, and they are looking for fun, lively couples. You can be dating, married, broken up, whatever. And if you or anyone you know had to seek medical attention during or following a night of lovemaking, this might be your chance. So if you sustained an injury, caused, triggered, or just happened while you're doing the deed, apply immediately for your chance to be on Sex Sent Me to the ER. To apply, you can visit www.sexsentmecasting.com. You can email apply@sexsentmecasting.com or call 818-728-4125 right now. Thanks and enjoy the episode. Just like to give a shout out to our brand new sponsor, thesweethoneypot.com. That is www.thesweethoneypot.com. It is your passion playground, and you should go check out their site because they are bringing sex positivity to you today by sponsoring this episode. And what do they have for you to peruse? A huge selection of items for all genders. There's lingerie in a huge diversity of sizes, and everything has user reviews, and there's videos for most of the products so you can actually see how it works and how the experience has been for other people who've tried it. The billing is discreet and the shipping is discreet. 24-hour customer service, and they're giving us a special deal just for you Sex with Simmery listeners. If you use Timmery, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, you get $10 off of your next purchase, as long as it's over $50. So use T-I-M-A-R-E-E to get $10 off your first, next, every purchase. Again, www.thesweethoneypot.com is your passion playground. I want to thank them for bringing you this episode, and enjoy. Welcome to Sex with Timmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I am very excited for today's conversation. We are talking to a law scholar who has not one, but two books out, and the new one has a lot to do with sex, which is obviously of interest to me. So I would like to introduce to you Eric Berkowitz. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Timmery. Glad to be talking with you.
So the law and sexuality, like on their face, seem like very different things. Like lawyers aren't necessarily like known for their like showing a lot of leg or anything, but there's a whole lot of sexuality that the law deals with. So like what are some of the biggest topics that are coming up, especially today?
Oh my God, there are so many. Well, you know, sex itself doesn't seem to have changed a whole lot over the years, but what does change is how we view the sex of other people. And from one of the things that I've found in writing these books is that, you know, what is accepted in one decade or in one culture is, you know, harshly forbidden in another. And it seems like the urge to judge the sex of others is almost as strong as the urge for sex itself. And so, you know, all that you need to do is go to any news page and you're pretty much 20 to 30% of the stories that you're going to read somehow, somewhere deal with sex. And if you go even a little bit deeper, which isn't hard, you're going to find somehow, somewhere, someone is trying to limit the sexual activity of other people. So gay marriage, huge. But gay marriage couldn't have even happened unless gay sex itself was dealt with by the law. And that finally happened as recently as 2003. Gay sex, prostitution, racial issues keep on coming up, sex trafficking. Sex is everywhere. And the law is a particularly clumsy, you know, forum for dealing with it. But that's how it is. You know, and there's a very strong urge by everybody to express themselves through judging the sex of others. And that's the, and there are many stories in that regard, and those are, and some of them are, you know, put down in my book.
So before we go on, I just want to draw attention to the fact that while you were giving this very erudite, like, interesting exposition about that, you added the term "go a little deeper," which isn't that hard, and I did my best and didn't snort laugh. So I would just like to say congrats to me on that. You
know, there's always one of the things that happens, and one of the things that I wrote about is that there's nothing can kill a conversation in a dinner party better than telling the group that you're writing a book about sex law. I found this often.
What?
Because
that's
people
such a great topic.
Immediately smirk, and then they get uncomfortable, and then they wonder whether if they ask any questions, they're going to reveal too much about themselves. Mm. Now, on a show like this, it's easy because there's not a lot of limitations here, but people get pretty darn nervous about it. So humor is always there. When people are nervous, humor's there, and I don't shy away from that.
So what drew you to this particular area of the law?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and I started writing full-time about, 12 or 13 years ago. And it's interesting. It was kind of a mistake that drew me to this, because I started writing a very broad history of the law, which was a really harebrained idea, because it's too big. So I was messed up about this, and I decided to get started by looking at the earliest laws that I could find. The first, the earliest, the oldest. And I did. And they were about 5,000 years old, and they're from Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq. And I pulled up some of the old legal codes, and fully a third of them, maybe even more, maybe half, had to do with sex and families and adultery and animals, lots of animals. Lots of adultery. And it struck me that if these were the first laws, not the first laws written, but the first ones that we had, and this is what people were thinking about, I followed the thread, and I realized that writing about sex law was a really good way into getting how people think generally. Sex is never far from anyone's mind. And in fact, it's never not in anyone's mind. And so that struck me as a way in, and I just followed the thread. And the first book carried us up to the turn of the 20th century, and my last book carries us into the present day.
So I actually didn't mention this before, but I am a huge fan of your first book. It was Sex and Punishment's the correct title, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
No, I'm a huge fan. I remember just being like, why is this not in every classroom? Because this seems like it has so much applicability to like every facet of life. I mean, we're talking about what human beings are allowed to do, and some of it just like it's shaped by every other facet. So like sexuality is one of those subjects that literally touches on every other one. And the same thing could be said of the law, because it's not just
sure.
like this, you know, insular, isolated topic. So, I mean, it's everything. It's literally everything. There's nothing the law doesn't touch, and there's nothing that sexuality isn't involved in. So it's just, why, like, I was just like, yes, basically.
Well, you know, a French philosopher, and I don't generally read a lot of philosophy, but Michel Foucault said something really interesting. He said, sex is a very dense transfer point for power. And I think he had a sense of humor there too by using the word dense, in the sense that sex is where the rubber meets the road. Sex is where people are really expressing themselves. Sex is where people are revealing and succumbing to the urges, you know, that keep life going. And that's exactly where the law and where lawmakers like to strike people. So there's a lot of law that is really, you know, plainly absurd. And there's a lot of law, at least in the present day, that is supposed to be protecting people against harm. The problem is we often can't figure out whether we're protecting people or condemning people. And very often the same laws do the same thing. And so, for example, at the turn of the 20th century, the age of consent for sex was in most places 10 or 12.
Wow.
That's right, 10 or 12. That means that a 13-year-old girl or boy who has sex with a 50-year-old man or woman is perfectly fine. That happens now. One, I'm a father of a teenage girl, and if a 50-year-old man got near my teenage girl, I would be, you know, the first one with a shotgun. But the point is we raise the laws to 16, 17, 18, and ostensibly to protect kids. But very, very often those same laws were used to harm kids because no one could really get around the fact that kids – teenagers have sexuality. What a surprise.
Yeah.
And so very, very often we use those laws to police the sexuality, particularly of girls, much more than we use the laws to police the actions of men who like young people. So the law is constantly used as both a sword and a shield. And, you know, in the book, I, you know, try and keep as many interesting stories showing that. For example, also, just going on, you know, there were a lot of laws, it's shocking, barring sex between people of different races. And in the minds of the lawmakers, they were protecting the white race. How absurd is that? Protecting the white race from the unsuitable genes of not only African Americans, but of everyone else. Now, obviously, there's been sexual mixing between the races as long as the races have been next to one another. So is the law protecting whites or going against blacks? How is it used? Well, there's, you know, that becomes very, very interesting, especially when most of us are in, if you reach back far enough, a mix of some kind.
The idea of protecting children, I want to go back to that for a second. So,
oh, yeah.
I remember the first that I ever became like aware of sort of, so we have this concept now that like children are innocent until they get introduced to sexuality, that like if we don't tell them about it, they just won't figure it out and they'll never become curious about how it feels really good when you touch certain parts. But like that mm-hmm. certainly wasn't always the case. And I remember reading like Marjorie Hines has a book where she details that, because originally, you know, it'd been like, no, children are actually like these little imps. They're like just small adults and they're actually full of the devil. And that's, you know, that's also part of why it's okay to make them work in factories, because they're not, you know, they're not innocent little creatures like we've now decided that they are. And how much our laws are shifted by just like this completely arbitrary notion of how innately sinful like a young child is.
Oh, Timory, I am going to blow your mind right now. Yes, anyone who's been 12 can testify to the fact that 12-year-olds on up are very much sexual creatures. It's developing. They need protection. Absolutely. They don't have the right decision-making powers to decide whether or not a sexual experience is one that they want to go into or not. Absolutely. But here's something interesting. We passed all these sex offender laws over the last 20 years. And when you think sex offender, what's the first thing that you think about? The creep that hangs around a playground, the creep that drives slowly in front of a school and lures kids into his class. Yeah, there are some of those, absolutely, and guys like that need to get thrown away for a very, very long time. But I'm writing an article now for the Washington Post about the fact that just as we expanded all the sex offender laws, you won't believe this, but there are thousands of kids getting marked as sex offenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not making this up.
No,
kids 10, 12, 13 years old playing doctor with their friends, you know, taking baths with their sisters and brothers, doing what kids do in their clumsy, imperfect way. So if kids are the exact population that we're trying to protect, what the hell are we doing marking them as sex offenders? And when you're marked as a sex offender, your life is ruined. You can't live with other people. You can't get jobs. You have, you know, a lot of them wear GPS, et cetera. So I'm now writing a long piece about the injustice of using laws to protect kids against kids. And so just like you said, Timmery, are kids innocent imps, or are they sexual creatures to be marked as criminals sometimes? Well, I think neither. They're not imps, and they're not presumptively criminal. They're kids, and they're kids to be taken care of and helped. Why we punish them for anything, why we punish a 12 or 13-year-old criminally for anything, is simply beyond me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really challenging thing, because there's this assumption that every 12-year-old is developmentally, like, the same. And that every...
Which is, of course, wrong.
Yeah, that's a presumption made by people who don't know any 12-year-olds. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, we...
Or maybe forgot when they were, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, when we have these notions of, like, whether it's okay at whatever age, it seems really arbitrary, because I think that, like, you know, I know some 16-year-olds who can handle a lot more responsibility than some people in their 20s that I know. And it's really, age limits are obviously always going to be arbitrary. But when it comes to the law, you have to be arbitrary, because that's what it's about. It's about black and white. It's not about bringing in social workers and then they get to, like, assess your relative developmental
social
level.
Workers, you know, do really well when there's lots of laws, because it gives them jobs. I mean, there's a lot of social workers that sort of pursue these things, maybe not for all the right reasons. I mean, stop and think about it. In California, the age is 18. In Spain, the age is 15. Does that mean the Spanish population doesn't care about their kids as much as Californians do? I don't think so. In the UK, it's 16. We set these arbitrary lines, and I understand why we do it, but at the same time, you've got to jump in and see what the real circumstances are. So, you know, clearly marking kids as sex offenders is just insane and wrong. But, you know, oftentimes the real suspicion is men for young women. I don't think it's a real surprise that a lot of men have a pretty intense attraction to teenage girls. How they deal with that is sometimes not exactly consistent, because a lot of times it's the men who give into their attraction for teenage girls, or who are the ones that are beating their chests in legislatures saying we need to, you know, strengthen the laws. So again, sex is just, it's really the basis of the irrational. You know, St. Augustine, way back when, back in the 4th century, referred to the genitals as little dictators, as little, you know, imperial rulers that tell us what to do. And so he saw a good life as trying to resist that. I'm not quite sure that the genitals are really dictators, but they definitely make their desires known.
Well, he was a particular case, and I think that this sort of ties into the way that you were talking about some of the people who are most vociferous about, like, legislating morality and mm-hmm. you know, those sort of things actually are sort of projecting their own inability to handle their sexual feelings. Like, I mean, Augustine's often a particular example of someone whose personal life was actually a hot mess and then gets to...
Who's this?
St. Augustine, like, gets to regulate what everybody else gets to do after you've, you know, done all your own
badness.
He
had a very famous line. I'm sorry to interrupt. He had a very famous line of, "Lord, grant me willpower, but not yet."
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he was a highly sexual creature, and pretty much so does Wild Oats, until he discovered the value of resisting. And so, you know, we're on issues now that are also, even in the present day, jumping up 1,600 years. We just today, there's this issue that popped up about Donald Trump, you know, and whether or not he raped his wife and whether or not he could rape his wife. And his lawyers seem to get a little bit confused by saying even if he had sex forcibly with Ivana, it couldn't be true because men can't rape their wives. And he took a lot of grief for that.
As well, I think he should.
The truth is that men were able to rape their wives until very, very recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just astonishing. It denies all humanity to wives. It basically says that when they say, "I do" at the altar, they say, "You can" to their husbands for the rest of their lives. And it took a lot of work by a lot of people to turn that around.
That's an interesting history in and of itself. Can you talk a little bit about, like, how that changed, like, legally? I mean, I have a rough idea of, like, how it changed socially, but...
Sure. You know, when at the turn of the 20th century, when people talk about family values, and when you hear, whenever you hear the term family values, that's, you know, a bell going off. And when you hear people talk about going back to the old ways, they should maybe think about this, is at the turn of the 20th century, the family home was really more like an Assyrian torture chamber than it was some sort of, you know, fire-lit haven. Husbands pretty much had full power over their families. I mean, there was no chance they were ever going to get hit for child abuse of any kind. That whole notion was crazy. And wives, at least for many centuries up until then, were considered to be sort of dissolved. I mean, their very being had dissolved into their husbands. Until about the end of the 19th century, they weren't able to own property, file lawsuits. They were pretty much, you know, like the 11th finger of their husbands. So the notion of a wife being able to say no to her husband, it was nonsense. It just, no one thought of it like that. And so it was really only until the 20s and 30s when women got the right to vote, when women started to enter the workforce, and more than anything, when birth control began to become available. And I'm not just talking about the pill in the 60s. I'm talking about cheap latex condoms in the 30s and 40s. Finally, women can make a decision whether or not they want to get pregnant. And a lot of poor women were getting pregnant all the time. And that became, you know, quite a health burden. And so starting in the 60s, when birth control began to become more widely available, women began to take a much more, how could I put it, be much more concerned about their own bodies and whether and when and how they were having sex. And also with birth control, the idea of having sex purely for pleasure was unlocked. You could actually have sex simply for the fun of it, simply for the sensation. Now, as women began to gain more rights, the whole notion of spousal rape became one of the early battlefields for feminists. And I'm telling you, Timmery, there were endless battles. In fact, there was even one legislator that stood up in California and said, well, gosh, if you can't rape your wife, who can you rape? And so hearing that now in 2015, you know, it seems like utter nonsense, but that was mainstream stuff. So just as there's been a lot of harsh developments and there's been a lot of oppression that's still going on, we could at least stop and take a breath and say, for God's sakes, that's a good thing. At least legislators, you know, got the idea that a woman has a right to her own body, even vis-a-vis her husband. Right? You know, what do they say now? Rape is rape? Well, rape is rape. And it doesn't matter whether you're married or not. And so, you know, I could keep you on for a long time telling you these crazy, ludicrous, grim stories about, you know, men who trap their wives in motel rooms and, you know, literally rape them and say, well, she was my wife. There's, you know, what's the matter? That's my prerogative. So it's... Trump's lawyer was off by about 25 years. And what was a little crazy was he only started practicing law in the 90s. And that's when spousal rape had already been outlawed for about 10, 15 years in New York. So maybe when he's saying that, you know, men can't rape their wives, it was more wishful thinking for him than anything else.
It seems like a lot of the stuff we're mentioning is, from my vantage, because of course I live now, a positive progression that we are aiming to, well, except for the kid thing. I'm actually not sure, but
yeah, the kid thing is insane.
Yeah.
I mean, no one can quite reconcile themselves to the sexuality of youth. And I think that's always going to be volatile because it just is, you know. But you were about to ask me whether there were any positive developments or negative developments.
Well, I guess sort of just like an assessment in general. Are we heading towards a saner, more like empirically based idea of sexuality in terms of the law? Are we heading towards a greater amount of equality or other things that we might consider positive? Are there areas where we're moving backwards? What is your thought?
What a great question. I think we're going both directions at once, okay? I mean, let's talk about pornography, all right? So from where I stand, criminalizing pornography is pretty ridiculous. One, because it's not going to stop it. Two, because most people who are involved in pornography as models are doing it of their own free will, and a lot of people are making a living at it. Of course, if there's force involved or if there's any kind of lack of choice, then that becomes a whole set of crimes in and of itself. Okay, so just as pornography began to come, just as Playboy began to pile up, not in people's bottom drawers, but on people's tables, and just as much spicier fare came in, there was a very strong counter-reaction on both the left and the right. So what I'm saying is just as pornography becomes more available, people start blaming pornography for violence. There was a very strong radical feminist element that began to say that pornography causes rape, and that's still very, very much of an article of faith of the far right, is that pornography, in fact, the basic sexualization of culture causes crimes. So, you know, you're getting both a freeing up and a restriction at the same time. I have a story in my book about, I have several stories about the prosecutors, especially during the Bush administration, the Bush 2, which is pretty recent, going to Florida to sue pornographers on the internet because under the standards of Florida, it's very conservative. You know, they were able to jail a lot of guys in the business of internet porn that they could never jail if they actually prosecuted them in California or New York or even Miami. And so, you know, where there's always a strong counterbalance towards restriction at the same time that there is a movement towards opening up. So now we have gay marriage, which I think is wonderful, and gay sex has been legalized at least for 12 or 13 years, if not more. But at the same time, it's still legal to put your son or daughter through a gay cure. You know, the parents are still able, everywhere but California or New Jersey, to take their kid to some kind of exorcist and pray the gay away or purge the gay away. So it's acceptable for gay people to get married, thank God. But it's also acceptable for parents to pretty much damage their kids by trying to, you know, purge their sexuality away. I think it's going to be quite a while before those laws are changed. So, you know, what the law giveth, it taketh away. On the whole, I think we're moving in a good direction. On the whole, people are able to have sex out of choice more. People are able to have sex and protect themselves against STDs. This whole racial thing, which was such a gigantic issue for so long, is now fading away. You know, interracial couples are coming together more and more and more, and with every one of their children, that whole stigma starts to go away. So, you know, there's a very, very powerful urge on the right, but sex wins. It always does.
What about in terms of abortion? Because that's one of those areas where I feel like, especially among young people, there's a much more conservative stance than there had been in recent decades. Because I know a lot of young women who hold a sort of anti-choice stance basically because it's just been legal their whole lives. And so they don't have any concept of what in practicality the world would be like if abortion weren't a legal option. And then of course the death by a thousand paper cuts, like sort of legislative style that is being done to scale back, access to abortion.
That's another terrific question. I think it's really a class question. Okay. If you've got money, you're going to have an abortion, a safe abortion, if you want it. That's really been the way it's, that's been the American system, essentially, the rich win since at least the early 60s. What's happened with the 1,000 cuts that you refer to, which is a perfect analogy, is the first thing that they did, the anti-abortion characters, is to outlaw government support for abortions, meaning that if you're a poor woman, you can't get any government subsidies to have an abortion. So that means is immediately that poor women who don't have an extra $500 or more to figure out, you know, to smooth things over when they get pregnant and it's not an opportune time, are faced with some very, very hard choices. So yes, abortion is technically legal, but the 1,000 cuts are coming fast and furious. And I honestly, Tim Marie, can't tell you where that's going to go. I really don't. I think what you said is extremely important. We really forget how hard others worked for us to have certain basic rights. And when abortion becomes illegal again, and it basically is now in Texas, where there's only 3 or 4 places to get an abortion, and in several other states, essentially what you're having is more of a class war going on against poor women and more suffering and disease. And so abortion, it's a third rail. I can't imagine a country without a basic right to abortion. And, you know, I lived in Europe for several years, and the idea for the women I've met there of not being able to get an abortion paid for by the government is just astonishing to them. They are truly amazed at what American women have to go through.
One other thing that we've sort of gone around a little bit, we haven't really touched on, is sex work. And mm-hmm. that's another thing that varies dramatically from country to country, and even within our own country, because we obviously have Nevada outside of the individual cities that outlaw it. So there's a very active sex worker rights movement in the United States, and they're trying to advocate for it to be treated like any other industry, where there should be basic standards for employees and you know, to make it easier to report in cases of Johns who take advantage or commit violence. Are we headed anywhere good with that?
I don't really think so in the United States. We have, and again, this gets into the counter reactions that I was talking about earlier. You know, there's been a coalition on both the left and the right holding prostitution as being sort of the emblem of all that's wrong with modern sexualized culture. So, you know, I agree with you, Tim Marie, completely. I take the labor view that sex workers need to be protected like any other workers. In fact, more so, because there's a much higher danger of it. It's very dangerous work, or it can be dangerous work if you don't have basic protections. But what we've done, particularly since the Bush era, with the support of both the far left and the far right, for different reasons, they're very strange bedfellows, not to use a pun, is the religious right wants to outlaw prostitution for obvious reasons. And very many people at the far left want to outlaw prostitution in order to protect women, in fact, to make it further outlawed. So what we've done as a matter of national policy is we've blended the words sex trafficking and prostitution. Sex trafficking sounds really horrible, right? Sex trafficking sounds like you're stealing a girl from her village and you're taking her down to Bangkok and you're serving her up for the pleasures of disgusting men who are on sex vacations. But what's happened in the United States, sticking with our own country, is very, very often, and we don't even notice the change of language, garden variety vice raids are now characterized by the police as sex trafficking interventions. So they get a lot of federal money when they're fighting sex trafficking, but there's no trafficking going on. And what happens is we oftentimes hurt women by protecting them, in the sense that if you start arresting men who buy sex, which happens a lot, now, or you start broadcasting their names on billboards, which happens a lot, or putting them on lists, then you start driving the trade further and further underground. Because the men are skittish, obviously. That means that the trade goes further underground. Women have less, it's less visible. It's less, they have less ability to negotiate, to protect themselves. And so by equating all prostitution with sex trafficking, what we've done is use one catch-all phrase, which is very powerful, and at the same time dressed up old-time vice as that. So every Super Bowl, you will hear it. There will be an announcement by the police chief of whatever city that is that they'll call the Super Bowl as the biggest sex trafficking event of the year. And we're going to get a lot of people in, a lot of cops in with a lot of funding and a lot of, you know, brouhaha. And we're going to counteract sex trafficking. What they're doing is they're doing vice raids against prostitutes who are serving all the people coming in for the Super Bowl. Same with the Olympics. So there's an interesting model in Switzerland. They're very rational people over there. They have legalized prostitution, and there are special places where prostitutes can go fully in public. So a man can pick up a prostitute, take her in his car to a special place where there are little sort of like shelters where you pull your car in, and there's a microphone there, and there's a policeman not so far away. And in the car, the prostitute will service her client. And if the client starts to get difficult or violent or problematic, the police are not far away at all. So the transaction happens. There's health, you know, health services, full health services provided. And more than anything, the women are protected. And, you know, that to me seems almost too rational for the United States. In Sweden, what they've done is they've made the selling of sex legal, because they want to protect prostitutes, but the buying of sex illegal, which is about as ridiculous as what we have going on in this country. Again, because if you make the Johns too skittish, it just has the same effect of leaving women unprotected. And that's what they need. Sex is always going to get bought and sold. There's no great insult in saying that. The sole purpose of the law should be to extend protections to all involved. And that means, in this case, the women.
Cool. So just to reiterate for anybody who's listening, who's like, now I need to read these books. Your first one, Sex and Punishment, is already out, but you have a forthcoming one, The Boundaries of Desire, A Century of Good Sex, Bad Laws, and Changing Identities.
Yeah.
Can people find out more about you, and where can they get this stuff, and they want more? Tell them how to find it.
I love it. The book is technically coming out on August 11th, although it's available on Amazon now and all the other usual suspects. And if you go to the Amazon page, or better yet, if you go to your local bookstore, because there are still a few of those left, you know, you could see all the reviews. It's you know, there seems to be quite a bit of excitement, and I'm very happy about that. I really want the book to enter the debate on sex and hopefully be a voice of some kind of reason. You know, sex is a beautiful thing. We shouldn't make it ugly or forbidden. We should just make it as safe as we can and let people's fantasies go where they may.
Cool. So, thank you so much, Eric Berkowitz, author and, law scholar, for your time today. This has been lots of fun.
I've loved it. Thank you so much, Timmery.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And have a beautiful day.
Hey, Cadence. You want to be on TV? The hilarious TLC TV show Sex Sent Me to the ER is now casting nationwide for new episodes. You might recall them from previously being on the Sex with Timmery podcast. And they are looking for fun, lively couples. You can be dating, married, broken up, whatever. And if you or anyone you know had to seek medical attention during or following a night of lovemaking, this might be your chance. So if you sustained an injury, caused, triggered, or just happened while you're doing the deed, apply immediately for your chance to be on Sex Sent Me to the ER. To apply, you can visit www.sexsentmecasting.com. You can email apply@sexsentmecasting.com or call 818-728-4125 right now. Thanks and enjoy the episode. Just like to give a shout out to our brand new sponsor, thesweethoneypot.com. That is www.thesweethoneypot.com. It is your passion playground, and you should go check out their site because they are bringing sex positivity to you today by sponsoring this episode. And what do they have for you to peruse? A huge selection of items for all genders. There's lingerie in a huge diversity of sizes, and everything has user reviews, and there's videos for most of the products so you can actually see how it works and how the experience has been for other people who've tried it. The billing is discreet and the shipping is discreet, 24-hour customer service, and they're giving us a special deal just for you Sex with Timaree listeners. If you use Timaree, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, you get $10 off of your next purchase as long as it's over $50. So use T-I-M-A-R-E-E to get $10 off your first next every purchase. Again, www.thesweethoneypot.com is your passion playground. I want to thank them for bringing you this episode and enjoy. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timaree. Please check out more from sexwithtimaree.com, where Monday through Friday there's new content, including polls, weekly sex columns, and Friday sex links. And if you have any questions, comments, or violent reactions, please email them to sexwithtimaree@gmail.com. That's sexwithtimaree@gmail.com. And thank you.